are the differences between obligations and virtues? Are you responsible for actions you don't take? Can you skirt responsibility by remaining ignorant? Is charity optional? Should we be more obligated to our immediate surroundings? Morality, obligations and virtues coming up.
Philosophers.
So back to redeem himself, David picks the topic for this week.
Morality, obligation versus virtue.
Thanks, I hate it. No, I'm just kidding.
So we've talked about morality before, a long time ago. It was one of our first episodes, I think. But I'd like to bring up a specific thing about moral philosophy, secular moral philosophy. Specifically, dividing morality into two categories, obligation and virtue, and then also discussing whether this is actually a meaningful concept. Okay. Because I've heard folks divide them into these two concepts, and in some contexts, it's a very convenient way to frame morality, but it might also break down.
So let's talk a little bit about, I think we first should, you know, do our due diligence and let's talk terms a bit. So I have obligation and virtue pulled up. I have the full on Wikipedia articles because I think we're going to need to dig a little bit deeper, especially if we're looking for like a specific moral philosophy definition. Right. Okay. And we've talked about obligations before, that they're in a different context, but it's a similar idea of what an obligation is, maybe. And it says an obligation is a course of action that someone is required to take, whether legal or moral. Obligations are constraints. They limit freedom. That's a very interesting second simplified sentence. You also see has a semicolon. You don't see those very often anymore.
Sorry. I mean, I use them.
I know you do, but I use them, but it's a treat when see one that's not written by someone you know that uses them all the time.
They're nice.
People who are under obligations may choose to freely act under obligations. Freely, TM.
What?
That's the sentence.
Okay.
Yeah. Obligation exists when there is a choice to do what is morally good and what is morally unacceptable.
Right.
So it's interesting.
That's what makes it an obligation, is that if you fail to live up to the obligation, then you have done something that is unacceptable.
Okay. So let's look at how that, let's compare and contrast that to what a virtue is.
Yeah.
Virtue is moral excellence. It's an interesting
and vague and useless definition.
Right. A virtue is a trait or quality that is deemed to be morally good and thus is valued as a foundation of principle and moral good moral being.
Yes.
I probably would have made the same sense if I said moral good being, but whatever.
Anyway.
Personal virtues are characteristics valued as promoting collective and individual greatness. In other words, it is a behavior that shows high moral standards, doing what is right and avoiding what is wrong. The opposite of virtue is vice. Another example of this notion is merit in Asian traditions and
day. I guess.
I mean, there's only...
It's a Chinese word.
It's just Chinese, yes.
Anyway, so yeah, so the distinction here is, so like an example of a moral virtue might be charity. It's not morally unacceptable to not give your money to the poor, but people think it is a good thing if you do.
So to me, it almost seems like there's one way that you might look at it, and this might not be exactly 100% correct, but I could see this being a quick separation between two. Obligations are things that you have to do, whereas virtues are things that you don't have to do. They're both good things, but one you have
people
to do.
People will think better of you if you do morally virtuous things.
Right.
But they're not required.
Right. It's like virtues are the extra credit things and obligations are the requirements.
Right.
That's interesting as a concept.
So I'd like to jump into some examples.
Yes, let's do that.
Let's try to establish perhaps where the boundary might lie. So an example that I often hear given for a moral obligation, suppose
you are walking along the sidewalk in a place that has, I don't know, a canal or something, and you come across a child who is apparently drowning in the canal. You look around, there's nobody else to save this child. You have a moral obligation, so long as you think that it will not kill you in the process, to save this child from drowning.
Okay.
So like the boundary usually drawn where something stops being a moral obligation in dire cases like this is if you would put yourself in moral danger as well. Like an example of where that might occur. If someone's about to be hit by a moving vehicle and you don't think you have time to push them out of the way without endangering yourself as well, then it's not your obligation to do it.
Right. Or like a burning building.
It would be virtuous if you put your life in danger to help somebody else, but no one is going to fault you for not
doing enough,
putting your life at risk to help someone that you think you probably wouldn't be able to save anyway.
Right. Or like same child, but instead of drowning in a river, a burning building. Like,
right. You don't know if going into that. Yeah. You don't know if you're going to come back out of that burning building if you go in to save somebody.
Right. And it's unlikely that anyone in the after fact is going to go, I mean, you probably would have made, you know, it's understandable that you wouldn't want to run into a burning building.
Right.
You know? Okay. So that's the obligation.
Would you agree that the example of the drowning child is an example of an obligation?
Culturally, yes. I'm going to caveat that because I do think it depends on the culture, honestly. But then again, I was going to say moral codes tend to be downstream from the culture they're in.
Sure.
And while there might be aspects of those codes that seem to be shared across most human civilizations, if not all, don't want to overgeneralize.
So like removing all cultural factors that might apply, like, you know, this child is from a rival gang or something.
No, I mean, just like, is take it on a national level. I think it's a safe assumption that you assume with a child that it, I guess that would make it go above cultural, because it's, you know, just raw human morality, I guess, if you wish, you know.
Right. I think you would be hard pressed to find a society that does not value the child's life in this case.
Correct. That's an interesting point.
And so like, yeah, barring a circumstance like, so long as you don't think that you trying to save the child will result in you being pulled into the water and drowned yourself,
I would feel obliged to save the child, right, or to make a concerted effort.
Right. You might fail, but you should at least try.
Right. I would do my best, and barring any other obstacles, succeed to save the child.
Right.
Yeah. I would say it's an obligation.
Okay. Cool. I've already mentioned an example of a virtue, charity.
Yeah. I agree that charity is...
Or saving someone from a burning building.
Okay, yeah, charity's a good example, I think a better example of virtue, because you don't have to necessarily put yourself at risk to...
I mean, you put yourself at some risk,
yeah,
depending on your level of wealth. Like,
fair.
If I'm barely paying rent, then I am putting myself at risk by giving my money to someone who is poorer than me, because I might become homeless myself.
All right, I think maybe a better one then would be like volunteerism. Is a virtue, like volunteering to help free of charge, and because, yes, that's something we all seem to have. We all have time,
yeah.
Whereas we may not all have money, we all have time, even if it's just,
right. And people respect other people who are willing to do something for somebody else for nothing in return.
Yes,
for apparently nothing in return.
Right.
You do get something in return usually, because doing things that are morally virtuous generally gets you a reputation,
right?
Which is good for you.
Yeah, I think Kant had a lot to say about that. If you do it and you get any kind of recognition, then it wasn't actually virtuous, but he also hated himself. So,
yes.
But you gotta be careful. We're straying really close to real philosophy here. No, I'm just kidding. I do want to kind of hint on something that you brought up that you said that made me kind of perk up a little bit. You said most cultures, you would assume, place value on a child's life,
mm-hmm,
right? And for some reason that, like, it pinged something with me about how, like, a cultural value becomes an obligation or a virtue. Like, I wonder if there's a meaningful correlation between the value placed on something in a culture and when it becomes an obligation versus a virtue. Is it just a tiered system, or is there a different set of characteristics? That might be a topic for a different time, but it was interesting to think about.
Well, so no, that is actually something I wanted to raise today.
Okay.
It's like, where does the boundary lie? And honestly, like, we'll get here, but the more you think about it, the line begins to blur and kind of go away.
It really does. Because even in the example, the more extreme example of, well, most obligations, you wouldn't be expected to put your life at risk, right? Because that's something that no one wants to do, is risk their life, right?
Right.
Unnecessarily. But that unnecessarily carries an interesting subjective cost, you know?
Right.
Because there are definitely times when it's seen as an obligation. I mean, for example, you know, in war, in history, if you were an able-bodied man, for example, or like look at even the United States during World War II, we'll take a recent example. Everyone was obligated to contribute to the war effort. Even if you weren't in the military fighting, mm-hmm. you were expected to do your part. And so much so that you were even punished for violating ration rules, which, while they were in place as a practical measure for rationing, they weren't necessarily enforced that way. There was a huge stigma created instead, and social pressure was used to yep. help enforce rations, not just people with batons, you know? And it was way more effective, I would argue, than having people with batons running around hitting people that don't have, that have too many rations, you know, or whatever.
Right.
So you do absolutely put your life at risk contributing to a war effort, whether you realize it or not. You're throwing your lot in with a group that, if you were to lose, you contributed to that effort. You know, you were maybe not an enemy combatant, but you are part of the enemy, you know?
Yeah.
So at that point, that obligation might absolutely get you, you know, killed, or put your life at risk, or significant enough risk.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it starts to get real messy. So let's dig down on that a little bit, I guess, maybe.
Okay. It's interesting. Basically, like the situation with the social stigma around violating ration rules or other such things related to war, providing for a war effort, that is an interesting, like, lose-lose scenario, really.
It really is.
If you genuinely detest the war and don't want to support it, then if you choose out of principle not to support the war, then you will become ostracized by your community if they find out that you're doing this, or rather not doing it. And if you support the war, well, actually, in all practicality, it doesn't matter if you support the war or not. If your nation loses the war, you will be lumped in with everybody else who supported the war and will be treated as a defeated enemy, whatever consequences that might entail.
Right. I think let's look at the relationship dynamic, if you will, about the cultural institutions that construct and enforce these moral obligations and promote these virtues, and the individuals who end up acting on them. So one of the things I think might be a little interesting, and maybe a way we can start categorizing these things, is virtues are things that help the group, the cultural group that is ultimately enforcing the code of ethics that back these moral standings, right? Because
actually, I think that applies to obligations as well.
It does, but there's an important distinction.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the whole foundation of any sort of moral system, is it all has to do with being willing to sacrifice something of your own for the good of others.
Right.
However minute it may be.
But the difference is, and maybe this is the more meaningful distance, a virtue is something that helps, but there's a key difference. A vice, let's look at the opposite of what a virtue is.
A vice.
I think this is maybe the more meaningful difference. What's the difference between a vice and something, and whatever it is to not fulfill an obligation, whatever you would call that? What would be the opposite of an obligation? Like, say you were to violate an obligation, what would you call that besides maybe a taboo or...
Oh, that's exactly where I was going to go.
Yeah. So let's just for the sake, because vices may be taboos, but for the sake of this discussion, let's limit the term taboo to violating your obligations. Is that fair for just this discussion?
Sure.
Draw the distinction. The difference between a vice and a taboo harms the group, whereas a vice may just harm yourself. And you could make the argument that by extension, it harms the group because you being a part of the group, you know, it would bring harm to the overall general well-being, mm-hmm. but it may not directly harm others in the group. Like, for example, if I wanted to abuse drugs in seclusion, right? That's still a vice to consume drugs in seclusion in most cultures, or at least in our culture, or previous iterations of our culture in America. But it's not the same as necessarily, you're not failing to fulfill an obligation necessarily. You will by consequence, perhaps, but not just by abusing drugs in the instant.
Right.
So I think that might be what the meaningful difference is one is you're actively causing harm to the social cohesion on behalf of others, but the other is you're only causing harm to yourself.
So let me muddy the waters a little bit.
Sure.
So we'll take an example that you agreed was a very good example of a moral virtue, which is charity.
Yes.
Let's consider the charity of donating money to provide food for starving children in Africa. Okay?
Okay.
Consider this. We can make some sort of conversion between the number of dollars you donate to this charity and the number of children who are saved by it.
Yes.
Who are fed, live another day. Okay. By extension, that means if you choose not to donate, there is a certain number of deaths that is attributable to you.
Sure. No, I disagree.
Mm.
They're not attributable to me, I would say.
They're okay, it's as attributable to you as it is with the drowning child in the canal.
I disagree.
Why? What's the difference? Because in the case of the drowning child, I specify there's nobody else around to help.
Right.
So if you choose not to help, this child dies.
Yes.
It's the same situation.
It's not, though.
If you choose not to help, a child will die. At least a child will die.
True. But I'm not the only one who could help the starving children in Africa.
I submit that doesn't actually matter.
Okay.
Because unless there are already enough people willing to help to save every child, then there's at least some child you could help by donating.
Right. But there's also...
So there is at least some child who will die as a result of you not donating right now.
I disagree still. That's a very cosmopolitan way of looking at things. And I mean that in the like technical definition of that word, not the you live in a city definition of that word. I would say the reason being is there is a zone of responsibility, perhaps, that surrounds a person's ability to act directly on a problem. Say, for example, okay, would the same situation apply if I didn't know about the starving children in Africa? Would I still be held responsible for not donating if I wasn't aware?
Of course not.
So by making me aware, you're making me responsible.
Yes.
I think that's morally reprehensible in that case.
Why?
Because I think it's unfair to force an obligation on someone against their will. And by just telling me, if you make me responsible for something, it's very similar to it's almost the exact same thing as giving me a disease that I, like if you, it's the difference between you knowingly giving me a disease and ignorantly giving me a disease. One is way more morally reprehensible than the other. Because now you're having to make me take extra care of myself. And
I agree that in the case of the disease, that's the case. I don't know if that's the case in giving you a responsibility.
What's the difference? You're making me now responsible for something that I did not consent to.
I'm
that would cause harm to me. If I fail to take appropriate action.
In the case of the disease, yes.
Well, and not feeding starving children in Africa.
What harm will you suffer from knowing about the existence of starving children in Africa?
It's not the not knowing, it's the bearing of moral responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Adding that to someone else's plate means that a failure to fulfill a moral responsibility maybe not brings physical harm, but it's bringing a hit to my social credit score, if you will. Which could down the road lead to putting me in danger in the society. Because we can't forget the whole reason this exists.
But what you're essentially advocating for here, or the position you're espousing at this moment, is that it is immoral, or at the very least rude of me, to destroy your ignorance about a topic.
You're
basically saying,
yes,
you wish to be ignorant.
Yes, that's what I am saying in the context of a moral system that I disagree with, in which that I am held responsible for something that I disagree with the notion that.
But isn't that exactly what people do who are willfully ignorant about other things, like maybe religious teachings or other things, like people who are willfully ignorant about maybe certain scientific claims in which they're contributing to harming others unwittingly?
I would agree.
Is it wrong to inform those people of the harm that they're doing?
I think what I take issue with isn't necessary. Obviously, I would still want to know. I think information is better, right? I'm not necessarily disagreeing with knowledge being a virtue and knowing things, and you should strive to be less ignorant. And also, sharing information shouldn't necessarily come with a negative cost. That disincentivizes sharing information.
Yes.
I disagree with that. What I'm saying, though, is if I'm locked into a moral framework in which I have to bet my well-being against knowledge, I'll pick my well-being every time. And I don't think it's unreasonable for a human being to do that. If you're locked and confined into that type of a moral system, I would think it poor of someone to want to be less ignorant, because you're then opening yourself up to more risk. However, I'm not necessarily, I'm still disagreeing with the overarching system of essentially unconsenting responsibility. Like, I take issue at that level. But if you are going to lock me into the paradigm of I have to bear responsibility without my consent, right?
Well, perhaps with a limit. Like, so obviously, if you are already struggling, then it would be very hard to hold you to a responsibility to give your resources to somebody else.
But
which we've already discussed.
Sure.
But supposing that you do have the means,
you then enter a very slippery slope of what does it mean to have, like, what's enough for me becomes a subjective question. So, for example, say, and here's a different example. So say I myself, and I have a spouse and I have two children, right? I need enough to house, protect from the elements, whatever that means at a minimum,
mm-hmm.
and feed those people. Let's uh-huh. just say those two, you know, we'll put those two axes on here. Any excess I would have should go to someone else. Otherwise, I would be considered morally reprehensible for letting someone die. And the argument I've heard for this is, okay, take the starving child in Africa, right? Say you had a third child and the starving child in Africa. Which one of those do I prioritize to feed if I only have enough food rations for one additional person? So I have my four family members that I already had, and I have a fifth ration available, or resources to acquire it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be held morally responsible unless I give it to someone, right?
Yeah.
That's the requirement. I don't necessarily have to give it to the one specific child in Africa. I just have to give it to somebody who needs it,
mm-hmm.
right? Should I give it to the one, my own child, or the one in Africa?
Your own child.
Why?
Because.
What's the difference? If I'm held equally morally reprehensible for a child dying, if I don't give it to either, do I get more moral points, if you will, for giving it to my child or the child in Africa?
Or is it the same? I think society holds parents to a responsibility to their own children.
Why?
Because psychology.
You could say because psychology, but psychological reasons aside, because I could love a child that wasn't my biological child.
You could.
Right? What makes it the fact that it's mine different than not mine?
In principle, by having a child or adopting a child, you're accepting a responsibility for the well-being of that child as if it was yourself.
Right. So there's a difference in the moral responsibility you willingly accept and the moral responsibility you don't, I would argue in that case. And the moral responsibility you accept is worth more than the ones that you don't.
Okay, sure.
Right? But if there's a difference in that fixed of a system between moral responsibilities accepted, I would then be incentivized to only accept moral responsibilities that benefit me. For example, why not just have enough children to myself to feed instead of feeding children in Africa? Because I would also benefit biologically from having more of my own children. And thus you would create a moral incentive system that continuously further advantages those who already have those as an excess.
Maybe, maybe not. Because you must also consider the amount of resources that are going to be consumed by the very existence of those children.
Yeah. But that's why I'm having
them. So you can now weigh the costs and benefits of, like, should I have another child or would those resources be better spent elsewhere?
But I can't spend them. If I have enough to each according to my own, according to my need, I can't spend it on excess. I have to give it away under a moral obligation.
You're still spending
to others.
It, though.
Yeah, but I'm being forced to spend it on something that I don't have control over. Why not take control
well,
of that?
You do have control over it.
Do I?
Yes.
Okay.
You can exert control over it by giving your money toward it.
But you're not saying that I then take ownership of the child in Africa that I choose to feed?
No. But you're exerting some sort of agency.
Yeah, for myself, but that's meaningless, you know. If
it's not meaningless to the child who gets another meal because of it.
Yeah, but it's meaningless to me.
Why? If it's meaningless to you, then why would you do it?
Because I'm being morally obliged to.
Then it's not meaningless to you.
Yes, but I'm doing it out of a threat. I'm doing it for further self-preservation instead of self, what's the word I want to use here? Surviving versus thriving. I could thrive instead of survive. And so, for example, I'll say it's not a second child. Say, well, I've got this bigger farm I need to take care of. It takes money to run this farm.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'll generate more because of it and mm-hmm. make more profit.
Yeah.
But what if I just took those profits instead of donating them to those who need more, just keep building bigger farms until I have the world farm? You know, the selfish incentive system will always, I think, end up benefiting the individual more than, and that's the problem, is you're putting the moral, and that's ultimately the problem, I think, that morality is trying to solve, is the competing individual interest over the group interest, right? I think the problem is any way you might try to incentivize people to help others, if you're having them give up resources that they created themselves, you would have to have a more efficient system to compensate those resources to make it a viable incentive. I'd have to get more than I could have gotten giving it to myself to incentivize me to give it to someone else, right? And you can pseudo that system with fiat, right? You can make it so, or I say fiat, it is moral fiat, as opposed to the actual baton, social ostracization and mm-hmm. such. You could impose those sanctions on me to put your thumb on the scale to make it, to essentially inflate the value of giving my money away mm-hmm. to more than it would be if I kept it, right? But you're not creating any real value using inflation, and eventually the bubble will burst, just like it would in an economic sense. Like, do you see my issue with the system of essentially forced morality in that way, or essentially being boxed into an unconsenting group like that? Or am I talking hot air?
I don't know. I don't know. I find it a very tricky issue.
Oh, it definitely is, for sure.
And like, I think there might be more variables here to make that decision a lot more clear.
Maybe.
If we knew which ones to take into consideration.
What do you think are the other variables?
I'm not claiming to know those.
I'm just saying they might exist.
They might, like, yeah, there might be other things that we could think about that would make the answer to that question more clear.
Absolutely.
Really, just the thing that I was getting to, which you seem to have agreed with begrudgingly, is that you can be made immoral by being, by finding out, by being told about something that you could help with.
Yes, I do begrudgingly agree under that system, which is ironic considering I forever I held to the conviction that ignorance is not an excuse, and that you could still absolutely be held responsible for things you didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Which I still kind of think. I just haven't worked out how that works in the moral sense, because...
Well, we talked about this before, and I thought that you agreed then that... Well, maybe you didn't. So my position on this has consistently been, ignorance itself is not something that you can always be held responsible for. It's only when you try to remain ignorant that you're now being reprehensible.
So ignorance is a vice, more or less, whereas willing ignorance is a taboo or violating an obligation in the same framework.
Right. Well, like, because in this particular case especially, but in some other cases as well, like, you hear about, like, you begin to suspect that you're about to be told about something that you could help with, and you know that you'll now be morally obligated to act on it. And you say, no, shut up, I don't want to hear about that, because then I might have to do something good.
Right. Or I might have to change, you know?
Right.
Yeah, no.
Well, but you're not, like, the reason that you would change is because it would be good to make that change. So you do implicitly acknowledge that you're avoiding being better.
Well, you're avoiding being better for others, necessarily.
Right.
Because
you're avoiding doing more good things.
You know,
say, stop, I don't want to hear about this, because I would rather not do that good thing and do something else.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I think this kind of phenomena actually plays out in the real world a lot, especially in the attitude of people who, like myself, have at some point considered moving to the most remote or rural place possible, where my responsibility for my community would be much less.
Mm-hmm.
So say, for example, I flee an inner city which has a much higher density of people. So there's more people to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And go live on a farm in the middle of a very lowly populated area where the only person I have to take care of is myself. And most of the other people out there move there for the same reason. They're already self-sufficient because the social systems that have been constructed in cities don't exist in the same way in rural areas. So they move to rural areas to get away from the fuss. But what they're really talking about in part is, I don't have to see homelessness, for example. I don't have to be concerned about it. Not even for my safety, but because I feel bad when I see that there's a homeless person there. I can just move to the country and have a nice farmhouse and a big farm and live a very relatively affluent life.
Yeah.
But and not because I'm making more money, but because everything here's cheaper and I don't have to deal with that problem. But in the same way, you're also leaving that problem at the feet of other people. If you view it through that lens,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're increasing you're taking your responsibility, abdicating it, and then divvying it up equally amongst those in the area. I do think there is a component of human psychology, though, that gets exploited when you do find out about something, especially when it's a specific person, and something we haven't had to deal with in human history before. The reason you tended to care more about people in your immediate vicinity is because you could actually see them. And moderate suffering you can witness has a much greater impact than great suffering you only heard of.
Yes.
To a human. Because we seeing is believing, if you will, is a cheap way to say it. But if you can see it in front of your eyes, you're going to be much more emotionally...
Sure, yeah, like there's no question about it. I care more about my friends and family than I do about someone I've never met, even in my own city.
Right.
And I care more about people in my own city than I care about people in a city far away. And I care about people in my own country more than I care about people on the other side of the planet.
Right. But
not because I think they are worth more as people, necessarily.
Right.
But their situations are more likely to affect my situation, so I care more about them.
Well, that and previously, before you could share images and video, for example, and simulate the same kind of evocations, those were the only people that could evoke the same kind of feeling, you know? The familial difference between people you in your own city that you may have only seen as a passerby is that you see more clearly people you see more often, right? And this is a phenomenon that I think a lot of people may kind of understand, even if you don't recognize it. But, you know, let's take humans out of the equation for just a second. If you have ever purchased a new car or started driving a new car, you will see that car or other versions of that car on the road way more often all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you see it in more detail. Like you're more familiar with it, and the mind
notice it,
and the mind looks for familiar things.
Yeah. There's a name for that I forgot.
Yeah. I don't remember
that phenomenon, but
yeah, but people, you know, it's the same way. And familial even has the additional advantage of people and families tend to look alike, you know? So even if it's a family member you've never met before versus a stranger you never met before, if that family member has any family resemblance, you will favor a bias towards that person. Granted, you have positive feelings towards your family, you know, over a stranger, you know, and it's a human bias thing that's been built in to help us care about those things. You know, it's like maybe a leftover from the fact that parents care about their kids over other kids, even though they care about all kids. There's it's a Venn diagram. It's not all or the other. There's some overlap, mm-hmm. But you do lean more towards your children because it looked like me, you know, or it looked like my spouse, you know, especially as they get older, you show favoritism towards it, not just because it's yours.
It's not necessarily that though. Like, cause you can get that kind of attachment toward an adopted child too, that doesn't look like you at all.
You absolutely could through just familiarity.
Right, exactly. Familiarity, yeah, you end up creating a psychological association.
Yeah. And previously in human societies, that association only gets formed by people you actually see. But now that I can look at a video of an African child starving and it still evokes emotions because it's a starving child, yes. You know? Yeah, it makes you feel like you're morally responsible, or you feel a responsibility. I mean,
that's the purpose of those advertisements, yes.
And that's the purpose, yeah. An ad with just words describing the most horrific event versus a still photo of a child just looking hungry. The photo of the child looking hungry is going to get way more donations,
mm-hmm.
You know. But it opens us up to the logistical issue of we are currently unable to even feed everybody in our own country, even though we have 3 times the amount of food to do so. Like, the task at hand is much more difficult to resolve than it would have been previously. Like, the difference between saving a child drowning in front of you, which would require me to have the bare minimum strength to pull that child and the ability to swim, probably.
Depending.
But that's something I can physically do. The individual cannot physically, individually, solve world hunger. Like,
right.
I am not capable.
Or even, realistically, go to Africa and put food in the mouth of a child.
That one child, yeah. That is even a huge stretch for me as an individual. Even the wealthiest, most influential and powerful people in the world have a problem doing stuff like that. Even though just getting to Africa and finding that child and putting food in their mouth may not be as difficult for them as it is for me. I mean, we were talking about it in the before we started this episode. Bill Gates trying to eradicate mosquitoes and malaria. That's a huge undertaking. And he's one of the wealthiest, most arguably powerful people in the world. And he's still having a go at it, and it's still hard. You know? Right. So, I don't know that our previous moral systems that were confined to the previous constraints of our reality and our physical limitations scale well into a global society or whatever. You know, if you start treating it like that, you know, it's what you're doing is essentially is extending the societal benefits of what you would previously only extend to those in your immediate area to everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily saying it's even a bad thing, because I think that it might be beneficial. I think one of the reasons war is in great decline is because it made it personal. It put war in everyone's living room during Vietnam with TV. And we got to see how morally reprehensible the actions that took place were. Even though we're watching the air quote good guys, it didn't feel good, you know? It wasn't a romanticized image.
Right. The only reason we had a romanticized image of it before was because no one actually knew what it was like, except the people who actually fought in them.
Right. And they're even incentivized to come home and shut up about it, you know? Because no one wants to hear about the bad things that happened, because we don't like hearing about bad things.
Well, right. I mean, if you did something traumatic in combat, like that's probably not the thing you want to bring up around your family anyway. Like, why would you want to relive that moment?
Not only that, but as soon as you get back home, you know, still reeling in fresh PTSD, everyone who greets you with a smiling face and calls you a hero for it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But that's all propaganda.
Sure.
The soldiers are heroes, which, again, not trying to diminish any individual here, but the way we all feel about soldiers and warriors is propaganda and has been forever, you know?
Maybe with some exceptions, depending on how far back you go.
I don't know. Epic of Gilgamesh seemed to really romanticize the warrior, and it's the oldest known written version. Now, it had it at least even had a detailed take on the fact that it is a struggle, you know, like you don't get in modern propaganda, but... Or you do, but it always comes with the evaluation on a struggle being a virtue, which is arguable, or taking on a struggle you didn't necessarily have to. But I don't know. I guess the question I think would be is between virtues and obligations, back to kind of tie it into the original topic here. Do virtues and obligations have constraints on their, like, if they lose their practical benefit, you know, because you stretch them to a scope they don't work well in, you know, is it going to be the same? Are we going to lose the sense of virtue and obligation if you scope it up too high, you know? Because I would make the argument same thing as a law. Anytime a virtue is not honored.
I don't think so. Maybe it depends on what you mean. Like, I don't think that, like, physical scope matters a whole lot. I think it matters. I think people still need to prioritize what is going to be most effective at something. You know, like, take, for instance, if we're going to look at, let's pick an issue, women's rights. Okay.
Okay.
It's going to be a lot more meaningful for you to put your resources into expanding women's rights in, say, the Middle East than it is here.
Right. But what I'm saying, though, is let's take the women's rights as an example, okay? When women didn't have the right to vote in America, when they didn't have all the same rights as men did, you have living, breathing examples near you that you can look at and say, yeah, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but you have ability to do something. Like, I can actually vote to change this. I can actually go protest to the people who can change it.
Yeah.
Women's rights in Saudi Arabia. I can't go to Saudi Arabia and vote for that. Because A, there's not a democracy. And B, even if it was, I can't vote in their elections. I can protest to my government about it, but my government can't just do whatever.
Sure, you can't. You cannot employ the same tactics. No.
No, but.
But that doesn't mean you're powerless either.
You're less powerful, though. I think you're not powerless, but I would argue that you are less effective.
Yes, you're especially less effective if you try to use the same strategies. But you might be able to do stuff like either you could do it with resources. You could provide resources to people and empower them to do the things that you could do here. Or even without giving physical resources, you might be able to do something to spread information. You can provide information to people that can empower them.
Maybe, but
like there's other things that you could try to do that.
True.
If it's a goal you were pursuing.
But I also think that that is less effective. Ultimately, the perceived effectiveness is still lesser because you're removed from the direct solution, right? Like a problem you solve yourself feels way better than you funding the solution.
Right. But acknowledging the fact that if you flew to Saudi Arabia and protested for women's rights, you would be killed. Like, you can still do things to try to get closer to the point where that's not really a reality.
That's true, but I think the removing it from the personal is going to have a much diminished return on the individual incentive.
Maybe. My only point was that there are places in the world where women's rights are under much more threat than others.
Yes, that is true.
So, just because you expand your scope of concern more broadly, like physically, doesn't mean that you are expanding it to meaninglessness, because you can expand it into a scope where it actually becomes more meaningful.
I agree with that notion, but I think the farther you increase the scope, you reduce the effectiveness. And I think there's a threshold that once the effectiveness drops below this threshold, individuals would then become more highly incentivized to look at issues more domestic. Like, for example, you can see this now with women's rights movements in America.
Sure.
They talk about what goes on in Saudi Arabia, but not near as much as they talk about different problems that affect the same people here.
Yeah.
But on a, we're talking about pushing the envelope even further. It's more incentivizing to a base of supporters to address a problem here.
Sure.
And it's not just because we're selfish, I think, but because, well, I can actually change this. So instead of saying, all right, goal one is to get every woman the right to wear what she wants, just leave it at that.
Sure.
You can wear the clothes that you want. Instead of, the reason we didn't go, okay, globally do that
first. You can do a lot more good for women here by pushing for even more than that here than you could be by, okay, before I move on to anything else like right to vote, we must first liberate women's ability to dress how they please.
Globally, yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, cool. Yeah.
I think it's almost like a weird arms race almost. That's probably a bad word to use, but it's a race to see at what point you've pushed it so far here that you hit the ceiling, proverbial ceiling of like, okay, now you're asking for more than equality.
Mm-hmm.
But how farther than that can you go versus now we need to start reaching outward? Like, at what point do you stop building vertically and start building horizontally? And
I know where I draw my line, but...
But not everyone agrees.
Sure.
By the fact that there are still well-funded women organizations. Like, you've even seen tick-ups in things like certain cancers that just affect women, or majorly affect women. Like, breast cancer research receives way more funding than...
Prostate cancer.
Prostate cancer.
Yeah.
And it's not because, you know, one is necessarily more deadly than the other or not. It's, well, we got voting, we got, you know, we got all the things. So, woman right there, let's just vote, donate money to that as well.
I think there's more that goes into it than that.
Yeah, I'm oversimplifying it a lot. But what I'm saying, though, is there's still a very much more motivated base to support women as a group, right?
Sure. Well, yeah, society has valued women more than men. Men are disposable. Yeah,
exactly. And we want to be, honestly, if we're being 100%. Like, we're incentivized to do things that would make us more disposable
right. For
competitive sake. But that's a whole other thing. I don't want to get into that one right now. Because
I don't know if I would say want to be, but we are more willing to be. We have the psychology that makes us take more risks because we are disposable like that.
Yeah, our RNG character sheets tend to select more for risk. Anyway, which also leads to a higher mortality rate. But you see what I'm saying is that at some point you're going to reach a point where the individual will look at the cause and say, yeah, but compared to this other cause, it's not as valuable. And I think that might be kind of where some of nationalism might come from. Now, this is a huge stretch, but it's like, if you look at what nationalism really is, and I mean like capital N nationalism, right? Mm-hmm. Virtues are a huge part of nationalism. National virtues, you know?
Yeah.
Patriotism is a virtue. Preferring your country is a virtue. And I think the reason you see that is when in the modern world, when you have all of these, like, we all still want to help other people. I don't think that there's anyone out there that actively really just wants to hurt other people only. There's someone that person cares about. It's a meaningless number of people who don't care about at least one other person other than themselves. We all have that drive, I think, to help other people. But when you look at, okay, I've got the world. It's overwhelming. The human mind likes to start chopping problems into manageable pieces. And then it's a game of which piece do I care the most about? And I think
what will make the most impact against the things that I want.
Exactly. And when you look at, you know, this resurgence of both nationalism and socialism, they're both kind of in a resurgence right now. Both of those have very strong, much more so than I think just traditional, whatever you would call national in the like lowercase n, like this country would be virtues. They both take their virtues and obligations and ramp them up a lot because people are looking for a way to do that. Like, I need help because there are so many boxes that I could spend my entire life just figuring out what I want to give resources to. Right? The list has exceeded my ability to process within my thread life, you know? So I want to abdicate that responsibility, you know, and I think you saw something similar with Kony 2012. You know, that's a better example, I think, of where slacktivism became a term, not because people lost the will to help, but because we found a way to, you know, put the sugar water in on the, I helped a person feeling. You can feed that now virtually with hitting that like button. One like equals one child saved, right? You know, that was the meme.
TM.
But that was the biggest, one of the biggest marketing campaigns of all time on the like smallest budget. But it's, I think, because people were looking to help that child in Africa, you know, but, and they found a way to do it. Like, huh, I get a personal sensation of the click, you know, I liked.
Yes.
I shared. I changed my profile picture. Things I can do. Look, I can actually do something that helps. Even though it doesn't. Like,
yeah.
Beyond raising awareness. But,
which is important.
Right.
But if all we are is aware of something, you've still done nothing.
Yes. It's like, we are keenly aware of this problem. And it's still a problem.
Right.
And it almost feeds itself in a loop. The more aware of the problem you are, the more details about the problem you have that you need to make aware to more people. And it's almost like you get caught in this faux action loop of just information laundering without ever having an actual effect. And it's weird because I do think you start to see those blurred lines between vice and virtue, between virtue and obligations, you know, like take something that happened. I'm, you know, to preface, I'm not in the social media game. I cannot social media. Sorry, I'm not good at it, but I still have family members that do. So this is all going to be secondhand. There was a movement on Twitter not too long ago where if you were not a member of the black community, you were to put a black image as your post for that day to black out Twitter to highlight words of people in that community that were affected. This was after one of the deaths of a black individual at the hands of the police. I can't remember which one, and I don't want to wrongly attribute it. Doesn't really matter the specific instance, but this is what you were supposed to do.
Okay.
So this was put out. There's a PR thing that, hey, next Thursday, when you update your Instagram, do this. Now, the perception I got from that is that you're obliged to. It's not just a virtue that you want to let others speak that may have a more direct experience with this type of issue that you believe is happening.
Right, but you will be judged for failing to do so.
Exactly. It's not that as soon as inaction becomes a problem, where if I just don't post anything that day, you know, if I don't post anything, I'm having the arguably even less of an effect of posting a black image, right? But if I just don't post anything that day, that when that becomes worse than acting, you know, it becomes an obligation in my mind, mm-hmm. no longer a virtue.
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing to be obliged to do.
Yes. I think the case can be made that it's a waste of time.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think most protests are a waste of time. But sure. And I say that in lieu of other ways you could make a difference. But yeah, it was strange to see that become an obligation, you know. And we've talked about other obligations before where, you know, to us an obligation was when the onus was on you to act. And you could be held responsible for inaction. Then it became an obligation.
Yes.
And we both, I think, had pretty strong feelings about being held responsible for being inactive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's interesting. I think. I don't know. It's definitely a complicated issue. And, yeah. and it's made infinitely more complicated by the fact that we all technically have our own moral codes. I think every human being has their own,
sure,
maybe not unique, but unique enough moral code and priority. So it ultimately comes down to, I think the issue with obligations is it comes down to how quickly you're willing to adopt or change your moral code out of a threat from the group, you know, be it tacit or actual, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, the libertarian in me is just like not okay with that. You know, I should be free to enact as much as I can. But the issue also is that virtue and obligations live in the land of social consequences, which I'm okay with. And that's the other thing where it's like, I mean, even if I'm not beaten, if no one wants to trade with me and I have all this water, but I can't trade it for food, I'm still dead, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know. It's definitely a way more complicated issue than I think we could cover in an hour episode.
Sure.
But I do think it's worth talking about and just being aware of the fact that, you know, hey, these two classifications of things exist.
Sort of.
How would an individual go about classifying things as vices and or virtues and obligations in your own life?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then stand back and look at those things that just apply to you based on how you feel. And see if anything doesn't line up, you know. Like, for me, the biggest one, you know, I'm going to kind of wrap it up. My long rant on a personal note. One of the biggest previous things that I held as an obligation that I gave up as an obligation but left as a virtue was my obligations to my family.
Hmm.
You know, and I don't get me wrong, I love my family. They were good to me growing up. But I was putting myself at disadvantaged situations and putting myself at greater risk just to do things that weren't of the same benefit to my family, you know, just because they were family. And once I stood back and just examined that activity and called into question, does this need to be an obligation? It really didn't need to be one. And I've benefited, I think, a lot since cutting the obligation. I would argue my family's benefited too, because now they have to take care of, you know, the amount of effort they would have to expend to cover what I was covering with an obligation is less than what I was having to expend as an obligation. And so they're better off for it because they have taken agency over those things. But I do still think it's a virtue to do things that help my family, you know, because mm-hmm. they're people I care about and I know. But if I hadn't sat back and looked at those two things through that lens, I would still be putting myself at disadvantage or risk fulfilling an obligation that I really don't need to, but I just kind of always did. Because if left on autopilot and you don't think about your thinking, you'll just keep doing the same things you've always done or be changed from external stimuli. So what about you? Is there anything that you had as an obligation that you kind of then reeled back and maybe decided this was more of a virtue? I shouldn't necessarily be obliged to do it.
Mm.
Without getting too personal, I don't want to put you on the spot.
I don't know that I ever felt really strong obligations toward family like that, but I did have a similar experience like that where I was more, I think really what that came down to for me was being less willing to be taken advantage of in that case.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was really moral obligation turning to virtue or what.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's all personal though at that point. So maybe that's where the change starts, is that we take moral inventory for ourselves, you know, to risk Jordan Petersoning myself. That's not a right way to say that. That name shouldn't be verbed. You know, I do think there is some value to starting with yourself before moving on to other issues.
Sure.
But I do think I've actually been thinking about that a lot. I've had a couple friends that have just recently taken the Jordan Peterson pill that might be a good episode to talk about sometime. Just not him specifically, but like his philosophy that he espouses as a way to live, you know, maybe looking at that like we did Christianity a while back for Christmas. That might be a good Christmas come around this year for the once a year we actually take an actual philosophy out there and
or every other year, apparently.
Every other year, apparently, yeah. So anyway, I'm content with to leave it here because I feel like any more
role. Sure, this is a good spot, I think.
Yeah. All right. Philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.